We're looking down what would have been Linda's driveway that she shared with her neighbor to the north, and it's pitch black. I can barely see the back of the neighbor's car that's parked a ways down the driveway. Current day, the property lines have changed, the house has changed. There's a fence now between the neighbor to the north and where Linda's property was, but back then there was no fence. There is a street light right out front of her house, but it is still pretty dark in the yard where Linda's house would have been. For someone to come back and light the fire, they had to know the property. They had to have been here before. There was a fence over here. You had to get to her house, you had to go that way.
Yep.
And it's dark. Did you get what you were trying to get?
Yeah.
Okay. I was happy to tell him why we were here.
My name is Jen Buchholz. I'm a forensics and criminal justice professor at American Military University, an Army veteran, and a criminal investigator for my local sheriff's department.
I'm George Jared. I'm an investigative journalist and award-winning true crime author.
Together, George and I are the lead investigators for AMU's Cold Case Investigative Team. This season, we're working to break the case for the family of Linda Malcolm. This podcast contains details and descriptions of actual homicide victims and their injuries, including sexual assault. Listener discretion is advised. Previously on Break the Case, Paul's theory was that the killer and arsonist are two separate people, and that the killer fled the scene and then confessed to somebody that night. And so that second person may have offered or just said, I'm going to go light the place on fire.
I tend to agree with him that if you have two different modus operandi working, that could be indicative of there being two different people working. Mm-hmm.
And so, correct me if I'm wrong, but most kitchen knives don't have a hilt, which is what would protect your hand from sliding down the blade of a knife.
That is very correct. And it would be pretty common to get a cut on your own hand if you stab someone and hit a bone. I think they are pretty good odds that they injured themselves. And from the looks of it, Linda was fighting back, so she may have injured them herself.
How bloody do you think the offender got during this?
I think that the offender got incredibly bloody. This had to be done in close proximity. This is very personal, and I think that our assailant really was covered in a large amount of blood.
Whoever it was so angry with her about something that they just kept at it. And I pray to God, and I will be there the day they get that person.
We've had a break in producing podcast episodes, but I assure listeners there has been no break in the investigation into Linda's murder. A lot of what we and the Port Orchard police have been working on the past few months couldn't be publicized. Recently, I decided to return to Port Orchard as there were several tasks I wanted to undertake that required me to be there in person. While I was in town, I reconnected with Robin, one of Linda's best friends. She has been an incredible help to our team during our investigation. Linda's murder has plagued her through the years, and she still struggles at times to discuss it, but she felt it was important for the killer to hear her voice. Hey everyone, so I am in Port Orchard this weekend and met up again with one of Linda's very good friends named Robin. We've met many times now, spent countless hours on the phone.
Yes, we have.
And so, Robin, can you tell us, how did you meet Linda? Tell our listeners what you want them to know about Linda.
I met Mrs. Malcolm over a $5 bet, and she was mad at me for the longest time. And then one time we met at a spot that we always seen each other at, which is the Golden Grill. And I asked her what her problem was, and she said, pay up on your bet. And after that, we became very, very, very close friends. We did a lot of fun things together.
Do you remember what year-ish it was?
In the 90s, I'm thinking.
Was it after she got out of the Navy?
Yes.
What are some of your favorite memories of stuff you guys would do?
There was a lot of different things that Malcolm and I used to do. We used to go to the park and walk her dog, Archie.
Yep.
Yep. And that was fun. And we did some drinking together.
Nothing wrong with that.
Yep. And we had a lot of friends that we hung out with. We did horse races. You know, we'd have to hook up at an establishment and watch the horse races, of course, you know. And see who's going to win. Then we put bets on each horse that we wanted to win. And whoever lost then had to either do something like clean a house or whatever for each other. She was a very fun, fun person.
So how would you describe her personality?
Her personality was very... She lit up a room when she walked in it. She was very confident. Loving, kind. She'd give you the shirt off her back if she could. She was a lover.
Yeah.
Definitely a lover.
That's what I've heard from pretty much everybody I've talked to that knew her.
Yeah.
She was outgoing. Was, and...
Very outgoing. Mm-hmm. But like I said, you adore if you've met her.
Yeah.
Yeah. She was just that type of a person.
So what's been your leading theory through the years on what happened to her?
Well, there's several different people that I can think of. I mean, Keith was a big one at first, and then he passed away of a drug overdose, whatever. That was a rumor. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of people that disliked Malcolm for the simple fact she was outgoing, and a lot of people were jealous of her, which I knew that. And if we were out somewheres and she'd start into a conversation, I said, don't even start. It's not worth your time, mm-hmm. nor mine and yours both. I go, let's move along. And we'd go somewhere else or go back to her house or go to my house or whatever we did, you know.
And so how did you find out about her murder?
My daughter called me on the phone and she said, Mom, have you looked at the news? And I said, no, because I had just gotten out of bed. And she goes, that is Malcolm's house, right? And I turned on the news as we were on the phone together. And sure enough, it was her house on fire.
Wow.
And I said, no way. And I lost it.
Yeah. And what'd you do then?
I called my mother and I said, Mom, we have to go for a road trip.
Yeah.
And we drove over there. We couldn't get that close because it was all taped off. But yeah, it was not a good morning for
me. Absolutely not. Was the fire still going when you guys drove over there?
No, the fire was out, but there was a lot of officials on scene. Mm-hmm. And it just so happened that when we drove by there, I seen her come out in the body bag.
Wow. I can't even imagine what that felt like.
And I said, Mom, stop. And Mom stopped the car right in the middle of Sydney Road, which that's not what we're supposed to do, but she did. And I go, no way. That is Malcolm right there.
So her killer is probably listening to this. What do you want to say to them?
You can... die worse than she did, because I'm really mad about this. This has haunted me for over 15 years of my life. For the first 4 years, I felt somebody was after me too, because her and I were so close and running buddies and doing our fun things. And then all of a sudden, you want to kill my best friend? Are you serious? You don't have but maybe one or two best friends in your life. My mama taught me that many young years ago, and it has destroyed me.
Yeah.
And I've been wondering, you know, all these years, and then I've got Jennifer and George on the case, and oh my God, I was just like shocked, blown away to meet up with the sisters. One of them looks like her, which absolutely floored me. I almost walked out of the library when I seen her, but it devastated my life. And yes, we do pick up and move on, but that's been very, very, very hard for me.
Absolutely. I always reiterate this, that a killer doesn't just take one life. They affect many, many people's life when they take
many people's lives. Malcolm was loved in this community for a lot that she even did too. But like I said, she lit up a room. She lit up wherever she went. She always, grocery store, I don't care where we went, dollar store, any shopping that we did, she always had something funny to say, and we'd be laughing, cracking up, walking down the aisle like a bunch of idiots, you know, whatever.
Is there anything else you want to say about it right now?
I want it solved, and I want it like yesterday solved, like,
yeah,
but that's all I guess I got for now.
You and Susie have been such a huge help with me and George on this case. I can't thank you guys enough for all your insight, connecting us with so many people. It would have been so much harder to connect with if we didn't have you guys. So I just appreciate you and all your help behind the scenes. People don't realize how much you guys have done. They will someday.
Right, right.
But we are super thankful to you guys. And we're not done here in Port Orchard. I got a couple more days meeting with the police chief tomorrow. And then you and I and Susie are hopefully going to meet up later tomorrow. In the day tomorrow.
Tomorrow. Yes. Perfect.
So thank you, Robin.
Thank you.
After a busy and productive weekend and before heading back to the airport to fly home, I called George to update him.
Hey, what's going on?
Hey, George. How goes it?
Going good.
Well, you know, I've been in Port Orchard all weekend with Jesse, and it's been super busy. I haven't had much time to really catch up with you except through text messages, but I just wanted to get on the phone for a little bit and record this because it'll just be a good way to update people that are following the case. We came up here on a Friday evening, and it's Tuesday morning now, so we're here like 3 full days, and the first thing we did was go over to the neighbor's property next door to Linda's house, because they said we could come over there and check out the terrain to the east. Alan said one of the original fire investigators has a theory that the killer ran to the east down the hill to the creek and dumped the knife down there, which we have looked at that imagery online, but we hadn't experienced it. So we brought the drone and put it up in the air, got some 360 video. A neighbor is super kind, walked us partway down his makeshift road that eventually will lead down to this creek. But I mean, it was daytime and it was treacherous. And looking towards Linda's property, it's even steeper. And, you know, it's full of wet leaves that are slippery and ivy that you would easily trip over. Like, I almost fell because my shoe got caught on an ivy vine. I mean, I don't know what your thoughts are, but I don't see someone trying to navigate down there in the middle of the night.
When Alan told us that this theory had been proposed to him, I was like, I just don't really see it. I mean,
I don't either.
It's possible. And also, that creek isn't very big. I think at some point a knife would have surfaced, you know, possibly.
Could have.
But like you said, it's the early morning. It's completely dark. It just doesn't make any sense to me. I guess anything's possible, but I would probably put that on a pretty low spectrum of things that potentially happened with the knife.
And like the neighbor pointed out, actually the other side of the creek, that hill is even steeper. And so he's like, how would you navigate up the other side? Again, it's not impossible, but it would be so difficult. Plus you got to cross the creek. It's not huge, like you said, but it's wide enough. You're going to get wet. You can't jump it, is what I'm saying.
And the other thing is, too, is you've got the Puget Sound just far away.
You've got a much bigger body of water nearby.
Yeah, where you're not going to get wet. I mean, you can quite literally drive up and throw that thing. Mm-hmm. There's probably plenty of spots where you can just throw it from your car, you know.
Yeah.
It's 3:30, 4 o'clock in the morning. There's very few people out, so you're not, like, worried about that.
Yeah.
So, nah. I'm not going to buy that one, I don't think.
Nah, that's a tough one for me, too. I mean, killers don't always think logically in the moment, but you also got to think statistically they're going to find the quickest, easiest way to get out of there without putting themselves in danger. And going down the paved road that goes right by her house makes a hell of a lot more sense to me. Which, I have something so interesting to tell you about that topic. I don't know how I forgot I had this, but I was going through all my documents and stuff on the plane, and I found the initial reporting officer's report, like the first law enforcement officer who got on scene before the fire department. I'm kicking myself. I can't believe I forgot about this report. Well, it names a second person who called 911, and we had never talked to that person. And so I went and found her. So she had been working at the jail or detentions down the street, I think in the courthouse complex, and she was coming up Sydney Avenue from work. She estimates probably 3:50, 3:55, and that's about the timestamp of her 911 call. And she came upon the fire. So she called 911, and this officer got there after her. So she stayed in her car in the street, I guess waiting for emergency responders or whatever. But here's the really interesting thing. So when we talked to her, she brought up that she remembers seeing a man walking away, like in the direction towards the water, like down Sydney Avenue. I call it up and down because it's a pretty hilly road.
Uh-huh.
And the way she worded it to me, my impression is that she figured someone was going to come interview her later. And so she kind of forced herself to remember this little detail because she thought it was odd. Unfortunately, she can't remember really anything about a description other than she's sure it was a man, and she thought it was odd that a human being would be walking away from a very obvious structure fire where people might need help. You know, usually as humans, we run towards it to help people. And she thought the person was wearing shorts. So I was like, whoa, if that's true, and that's our person walking away, you know, I'm like, were they walking to a car? Did they live in the neighborhood? I don't know. But if anybody who's listening and was on scene remembers anything like that, please let us know.
For sure. Wow, that's a big get.
Mm-hmm. That's the first we've heard of that.
How many people are up at that time of morning anyway, you know, out wandering around outside?
Exactly, yeah.
It almost makes me wonder, too, if she saw enough of this person to know for sure that it was a male, could that tell us that maybe the person was slightly taller or bigger just because they were more easily identifiable as a male in the dark? I don't know.
Probably. You know, I'm guessing a person looked a little stockier, like you said, taller or bigger than a female. So she seemed sure of that detail. And we did go up there at night. We confirmed that the same street lights are on that street as they were in 08, so the lighting's the same. And you could see pretty well down the sidewalks.
Mm-hmm.
Into the yard wasn't as easy, but I think once your eyes adjusted, there would be enough ambient light for the person to navigate around the yard and the house and stuff without a flashlight.
Yeah.
Oh, and she said she had her window rolled down, and she's like, I was across the street, and the heat from that fire, it was hot in my car. You know, she could feel it. And so if you got that big of a fire going, you got a big light source there, too.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking, is that the light from the fire probably
could be
illuminated this person as they were walking away.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
That is so interesting.
We went and found a couple other people that we'd wanted to talk to. Nothing major there, but I'm just glad we were able to connect. And then, of course, we had to go to the Golden Grill.
Of course.
We met three of Linda's friends there Saturday evening and hung out for quite a while, several hours. Robin was there, and this time she wanted to come on the podcast, so we did a recording outside, but she and I got pretty teary-eyed. I almost wish I had that recorded, because this still traumatizes her to this day. And she's like, I have to know who killed my best friend. It's so been so hard to live with this. And she's like, and the person I probably knew, the killer, and they might still be in this community, you know, and that's a scary thought.
Mm-hmm.
So we both got a little bit teary-eyed into the night, but sometimes it's good, you know, to be able to vent.
Yeah.
And something else that's come to light this weekend, so I'm not going to name names, obviously, but there's this little group of people who are either, when I've talked to them, they've either lied to me, or one of them just won't talk to me, period. I went to the house. They have a video doorbell. I rang it twice. I know they can see me on their phone. They saw me sit down on their stoop and write a note and leave my card in a note, and no callback. George, you and I have done this enough now. When we have people who are uncooperative, it's always a huge red flag, because look at all the other cases we've worked. We always do run into people who won't cooperate, and guess what? In a lot of cases, they're either tied to one of the suspects or the killer themselves, like in Rebecca's case. And I'm like, here we go again. So,
yep. Very telling.
Yep. So I'll get into my meeting with police, but I made them well aware of all of that. And I don't know. I mean, if somebody has no involvement, there's no reason to not talk to me, or there's no reason to lie to me. So I find that really interesting.
No, there's none.
So I really suspect at least one of these people at least has a very strong suspicion of what led to this murder and possibly what actually happened. Because I still believe Linda had some kind of like argument or verbal altercation with her killer in the couple days prior. And I'm wondering if one of these people that's lying to me or doesn't want to talk witnessed that. And so they suspect that that's what led to her murder. And for whatever reason, they don't want to come forward with that information.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I think that there's probably some information within that group of people who are connected.
Yeah. Yes.
They know something either directly or indirectly.
Yeah.
Because like you said, it's been our experience when people are uncooperative, there's a reason why.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I was thinking through all our other three cases before this one, and we had the same experience with people who we believe are linked to the killer or the murder.
Yeah, absolutely. That's very suspicious. So it sounds like we're going to have to probably keep pressing on those people to see if one of them will eventually talk.
Yeah. If you're listening, if you had no involvement, just think about if it was your family member that you lost in this horrific way. You would want somebody with information to come forward. And we can keep people confidential. You're not going to be outed. We're not putting you on a podcast. We're not going to write about you. We just need to know what you know. But anyways, it's still progress. When people lie to me, like we just talked about, you know, it piques my interest. And then I want to know more. In a way, I guess we've sort of forced some people's hands.
Yeah, and lying is also one of those things. It's like a big red flag. So it's not like if you lie to us, we're going to stop.
Right.
Just know that the exact opposite is going to happen. So if you want rid of us, just tell us what you know and move on.
When a crime is committed, clues live within digital devices. That's digital forensics. Learn how to process and analyze that data by earning a Bachelor's of Science in Digital Forensics from American Military University. Classes are online with monthly program starts. Learn more about AMU's Digital Forensics degree by visiting amuonline.com/forensics.
Monday, I had a lunch scheduled with Chief Brown. And honestly, when I emailed him about lunch, I thought, oh, he's going to be like, this is too unorthodox. Like, I don't need to go have lunch with this person. But he actually agreed right away and he set a meeting. And I was like, oh, this is fantastic. He prefaced in his email. He's like, I'm not intimately involved in any case in my department. So I know Linda's case superficially, and that's it. And we expect that. Like, the police chief doesn't have time to do investigations. But I didn't really want to talk to him about the specifics of her case. I think because you and I had talked through a few things, and our thinking was trying to work on the media plan. And I remember coming to you about this because you are media. But I was nervous because a lot of police departments, they don't really like the media and they don't want to put stuff out. But I thought it's worth a try. And so, George, we have known, we can put this out now, we have known for months that they found unknown DNA at the crime scene. And we have known that several months ago they got a grant to pay for investigative genetic genealogy to help identify the owner of that DNA. And so, but yes, obviously we had never revealed that because it wasn't our place. And so I asked Chief Brown if that was something he'd be willing to now confirm, because it won't harm the investigation. It's not like one of those details that only the killer would know. But I said,
his killer can't change his DNA either.
Yeah, so. Exactly. And I said, but it's probably going to make him a little nervous and panicky. And, you know, we kind of chuckled about it, but he goes, yeah, absolutely. And what was really cool is he texted Eli Meyer, who you and I and the sisters did an interview with last year. And I didn't realize Chief Brown and Eli were like that close of a working relationship, but they do. And I was like, well, I'm supposed to meet with Eli too. And so we were trying to put together a group interview, but it didn't work out. But anyways, he said, yeah, let's do that. Let's put that information out. And then I was like, well, I have one other idea. And he's like, sure, go for it, you know. And I said, well, you know, we have a podcast. We don't do this to make a podcast, but it's a media platform a lot of people listen to. Would you be willing to let Detective Walton come on and do an interview with me? And he agreed to that right away, too. And I'm just so excited. Even though they can't share the case file with us, I mean, this is a pretty ideal working relationship that we have going on, and I'm just really pleased with it.
Yeah, it really is. This has actually worked out very, very well. I wish that it could be this way with every law enforcement agency we work with, but I've been very pleased with the Port Orchard Police Department. Yeah. This has been good.
It's been a pleasure working with them. I think we agree on the MO of the person, you know, that the killer left the property, came back to light fire, things like that we agree on. I think it's more like our suspect lists don't completely overlap. There's a couple people that overlap, but we have a couple on ours that they don't have. Well, I shouldn't say they don't have them on theirs, but that are farther down their list. Let's put it that way. And, you know, they've got at least one that's towards the top of their list that we don't think did it, but that's fine. And I told them, I'm like, it's so good that we can debate these things, and whatever I can uncover about these people obviously goes to you, and you guys have the case file and you can compare. So I have no issue that we're not completely in agreement. I don't think there's any problem with that.
Yeah, that's true. That's very important to point out, too.
Yeah.
And actually, you and I disagree about a lot of stuff in different cases, and that's good. So if you have a theory, I have a theory, they have a theory. Eventually, when we collect up enough facts, it should either stand on its own as a good theory, or it should fall by the wayside.
Yeah, even a law enforcement investigator assigned to a case are going to get it wrong.
Yeah.
It's part of the process of getting it right. Anyways, Sergeant Brandon was there at lunch, so I gave him a thumb drive with everything that you and me and our team have collected. I think I organized it real well into folders for them. And it was like 30 gigs of stuff, if I remember right.
Wow.
So it was pretty significant. And I said, I know I've shared a lot over Google Drive, but some of the stuff didn't seem relevant, but it might be. So I just want you to have everything. And again, it's not a competition. We're just trying to augment them and help them out. And they seemed appreciative. So
yeah,
it was a good chat. It really was. I felt good about it.
Well, Jen, and there's also something else they're trying to do right now is they're trying to do some genetic genealogy, possibly.
Yep. They are doing it.
Solve this case. So what exactly are they doing and what do they help with on that front?
And this genealogy stuff is kind of complicated, but try to keep it in layman's terms. I actually just got certified in it. So there are several distant relatives that we know share a portion of DNA with our unknown from the crime scene. Detective Walton has reached out to at least one, asking if she could mail them a DNA kit would they do the swab and send it in so she could do a comparison, and they said no. And that is just hugely, hugely disappointing. I get it. It's probably scary to have a law enforcement agency call you asking about DNA and a crime. But let me assure everybody out there, if you ever get that call, please go ahead and do it. They will never actually have your DNA profile. Meaning, they're never going to have your actual profile that could, for instance, be planted at a scene, that could be uploaded into CODIS, that could be used to figure out your health history. They will never have that. It is converted into a coded form, and it's gibberish. It's basically useless other than making comparisons to other people's coded forms of DNA. I just can't reassure the public enough on this. It's not going to go in a law enforcement database. But we're talking about a heinous murder. Please, if somebody calls you with this request, please go ahead and agree to do it. The killer's never going to know whose DNA matched up with theirs. It's, you know,
right. It's
all protected. I mean, it's a long shot. I would love if the person who said no is listening to this. If you are, I literally just went through the whole course on all this. I'd be happy to get on the phone with you, explain all the confidentiality and everything surrounding it. And I know Linda's family is quite upset, understandably, but that's not the only relative alive that they could get DNA from. So they do have more on the list. They're not going to share the list with us or the public, and you and I, unless they tasked us to go get someone's trash or something, we're not in a position to go help them collect DNA. They've got to do that.
Interesting. Well, I really hope the person who opted to not give their DNA is listening to this and maybe has a change of heart, because it would just make it easier. I mean, the thing about it is, Jen, like, we both know if push comes to shove, we'll get DNA from that family somehow, some way.
You and I have no problem traveling somewhere.
None.
I've done a ton of surveillance work, and it would not be hard for me to locate a person, follow them, and get their DNA or get their trash.
I would be shocked how, I mean, the hardest part would be just getting to wherever they're at. That would be it.
Mm-hmm.
We have a whole plethora of examples. I mean, the guy that was just arrested in the Gilgo Beach, you know, murders, they got his DNA from a piece of pizza that he threw away outside his office. So
you got it.
Paul Hull solved the Golden State Killer case. Mm-hmm. I mean, or was on the team that did it. And they went out and got DNA out of trash cans. So we can do that. It's not no problem.
Yeah. And we don't know Paul Hull's really well, but we do have a connection to him. And this would be a time when, if someone needs additional reassurance from a professional who's been in this business for years, I would absolutely reach out to him and ask him to have a conversation, and I'm sure he would do it. So this is just critical. I mean, the genealogy stuff is solving cases every day. We just surpassed 650 at the end of last month. It's a proven technique. It holds up in court. Lots of case precedents now, and DNA doesn't lie. I mean,
no, and you can't change it. So
no. So anyways, we're long-winded on that, but I think we kind of have to be. But we're going to put together more podcast episodes now, and we're going to kind of try to slam all media platforms with the information about the unknown DNA profile. So if that's yours, I hope it's making you panic.
Yeah.
I hope you have a good explanation for it being there. All right, George, well, we got our stuff packed, and we got to drive over to Seattle. I'm going to call the main library in Seattle on the way and see if they have video archives from news stations, and if they do, we're going to try to swing by there. I'll be back home, but we're still plowing ahead on this case and working hard.
Absolutely. Well, you and Jesse travel safe.
All right, George, enjoy your week, and we'll talk soon.
Jen, you do the same. Bye-bye. All right,
bye. Next time on Break the Case.
I am Detective Walton with Port Orchard Police Department. I am the detective assigned to the case of Linda Malcolm. Yeah, I definitely believe that the killer, or at least someone who knows what happened, is still out there. They thought about maybe just making it look like it was accidental and hoped that her body would not be found until it was also consumed in the fire, which they were wrong. We did recover some DNA at the scene. And I can tell you that we've also been given a grant through the Attorney General's office for additional investigators to assist us. And that grant has also covered testing of the DNA through genealogical databases.
This podcast is brought to you by American Military University. Narrated and produced by Jen Buchholz with co-host and investigative journalist George Jared. Senior producers Leishan Kranick, Andy Crow, and Kristen Kretzler. Sound engineering and editing by Harvest Creative Services. Subscribe to Break the Case on iHeartRadio, Google, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your podcasts.